your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We just finished up hour one with the Transformation of America, part one, and we're going to be talking about and extending that conversation with Transformation of America, part two. We basically divided this from the part one would be George Washington to JFK, right before that, then the JFK assassination on to present times. So basically we're going to start a little bit before into the 50s. I'm going to go back into the 50s and explain myself and my experiences as a young teenager, preteen growing up here in Austin, Texas, and what my comments would be about what the quality of life and so on at that time. But the ideas that we had back then in the 50s and the responsibility, I will say this, is that what occurred back then, okay, was more of a responsibility thing than I see occurring today. And in that you could say sense of responsibility, it seemed like we were more responsible. I don't know. We had a different society than we have today. It was more churchy, you could say. Some people would, you know, debate that and not like this idea of the church or something. I'd say that in the 50s we had a much larger focus on church and religion than we have today, from what I could tell, you know, overall. And as a result, then we had a society that, in my way of thinking, was much more responsible than the one we have today. But that's just my own views and so forth. And it may not be that accurate in the long term, see. But anyway, it seemed to be back then that we had a group of individuals. And my father, I mean, he meant his business. I mean, if you said to be at home at sundown, by God, you were there or you got punished, see. There were consequences back then. Do we have consequences today? Well, it's changed. Okay, let's get back here to the 50s then. And we're moving from the 50s into, say, the JFK thing. Okay. Well, it denotes a major change in the country. When the JFK assassination occurred, I was actually at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, in the Army, and I was in electronics school up there at Fort Devens, okay? And what we had there at Fort Devens was electronics school. It was the Army Security Agency, okay? And one day there was an announcement, and it hit all over the post that JFK had been assassinated in Dallas. Of course, that made you could say all of the ASA people that were from Texas, non-gratis people. I mean, all over Fort Devens, we weren't were well thought of, and they all knew the Texans because we all stuck together. A lot of us did, and the Texans had that twang, that Texas twang, and so forth. So we know now, looking back at the JFK thing, assassination, and we had in last November, on the 21st of November of last year, 2013, we had a symposium. We had Jim Mars there, and we had Judith Baker, the girlfriend of Lee Harvey Oswald, and Luke Rakowski was good enough to come in, and Milligan, Chris Milligan, and Ty, we had several other people. And they all spoke very eloquently. We had John B. Wells was there also, probably the biggest name. Well, Jim Mars, pretty big. And we talked about the JFK assassination. It is pretty well agreed on now by a lot of people that, yes, there was assassination. And it began to be a milestone in American history because looking back on it now, the most powerful people in the country and then elements of Europeans and Canadians and so forth helped carry it out. So when we were at the Copenhagen and we were protesting against the Bilderberg group, these are some of the ideas and things that would run through my head, that here we are, we're in Copenhagen, the richest people, the most influential group, single group in the world is meeting, okay? And what are they really all about? You know what I mean? And they're about consolidating their power and extending control over the world's people. They're all about using Facebook and Google and all these social networks and programs and so forth to control people and find out what our inner thoughts are. That's what they're all about. They're not really about helping us, to move forward, but they're and become more free, with liberty and freedoms. They're for controlling us more. They're also about protecting their own interest. So you could say that they have controlling networks out there that they've created between us and them that will control and, control their interests, control our interest to their benefit, so to speak. But anyway, getting back to the JFK thing, it was a milestone in the sense that a major conspiracy did ensue. It has become pretty evident now that the biggest movers and shakers took part in it and helped affect the JFK assassination and carried it off and got away with it, and then LBJ swept it under the carpet for 40, 50, 70 years now, so he was part of it also. There's been Barr McClellan written books on it. His girlfriend was there at Murchison's mansion at the night before the assassination. And so there's all kinds of evidence about what went on there. And so there's no question now that it was a major conspiracy. But what it did do was, up until that time, I believe that the Kennedy boys, Joe Kennedy, their father, was actually in business with Lucky Luciano, which is a major crime figure out of New York, who had run the streets with Bugsy Siegel and others. And so he helped throw the election. Joe Kennedy did. He brought in some of the Chicago people and the labor, and they threw the election for JFK. Whether we don't know if JFK's full knowledge of that was there, but he did win with his father's help. Then John JFK and his brother Robert started going in there and attacking organized crime and so forth, and started investigations. Robert Kennedy was attorney general, and he started putting on trial certain crime figures and going after them. There was a series of committee meetings and so forth. What had happened earlier before that in the 50s was that there were hearings about organized crime that JFK was a member of the committees, and his brother Robert was a counsel to those committee meetings and hearings, and out came what came out of those hearings was a knowledge, you could say, of organized crime by the Kennedy brothers that had never existed before, because they had firsthand information there that the committee had used for the investigation. Then they were beginning to be knowledgeable, but they couldn't exactly ignore their father's relationships with people like Lucky Luciano either. But I believe truly they were sincere about going after the mob and some of those mob figures, and they were trying to reform to a degree, okay, this thing called organized crime, you know. And his Navy service, Robert, both had Navy service, and then also, but the most important thing that I would say on Robert's career, okay, was that he was assistant counsel of the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and so he did know McCarthy in there, see, and but he did perform his duties there as a counsel on that committee rather well. But in getting into that, he began to see what some of these organized crime figures were all about, and they begin to understand, see. Like, he made a name, Robert Kennedy made a name for himself as the chief counsel of the 1957 to 59 Senate Labor Rackets Committee under Chairman John L. McClellan, see. And Kennedy squared off with Teamsters Union President Jimmy Hoffa during the antagonistic argument that marked Hoffa's testimony. And then Kennedy left the Rackets Committee in the late 1950s in order to run his brother's John JFK's successful presidential campaign. Also, Robert wrote a book and published a book called The Enemy Within, describing the corrupt practices within the Teamsters and other unions that he had helped investigate, and the book sold rather well. So you had, this is some of the background to the Kennedys beginning to realize, see, about the rackets and about this organized crime threat to America, see. And he wrote this book. To write any book, the enemy within, you've got to get out there and do a lot of research. So he did realize this, and Robert and JFK together then wanted to reform the country to some degree. And then JFK was assassinated, and then Robert took up the bullhorn, you could say, speaking to civil rights groups in front of the Justice Department after his brother, you know, well, shortly before his brother's death, you could say. And he went on a campaign himself to become president. But that was not realized because of his own assassination. So that similar people, we would say, that participated in the JFK assassination did Robert Kennedy also, because they didn't want a threat to their power system. And then John, the son, JFK's son, later would die in an airplane crash that was questionable as to the what really happened there, you know, in the airplane crash. So we don't know exactly all the details, but we can hypothesize and perhaps speculate that he was beginning to want to run for the Senate, U.S. Senate from New York, and Hillary had the aspirations also, so she winds up getting it, and he goes down in an airplane crash. But that's highly questionable too. But coming out of the 60s, then we had a continuous rise, you could say. Let me go back to one other thing here that I have to add to this. I talked about the 1947 National Security Act that set up the CIA and other intelligence agencies and so forth. But there was another thing that happened in 19 an important thing that happened. And that would be that Kurt, K-U-R-T, Lewin, L-E-W-I-N. And that's a name you got to look up in Wikipedia and other and do some deep research on it. He comes over from Germany by way of the Tavistock Institute to this country. He actually founded, he's a founder of group dynamics and group management. So as a result, he was far advanced in 1947, okay, in these fields of study, okay. And what he brought to the forefront was, and what has come out of that today, he's the founder of social psychology. And he was one of the first to study group dynamics and organizational development. And basically what that did was give rise to a corporation system and indoctrination and so, and propagandizing within these corporations, to make the workers more efficient and more dedicated to these giant corporations, see. But he died soon after arriving here. Actually, he arrived here earlier than 47, but his death was in, as I understand, 1947. So it was somewhat, his career was somewhat cut by an early death, you know. But he created a system of group dynamics and group management and so forth, which carried on later on into to the rest of the world, you know. So anyway, the essence of what we're talking about here is that the picking up after the JFK thing. Let's get back there. I'm going back and forth a little bit to fill in some of the blanks here. But after the JFK thing, Robert and JFK, they both wanted to do what was right for the country. They were both assassinated. Martin Luther King also was assassinated during that period. And you had the rise during the Vietnam War of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society. And then what spawned off of that was the Weatherman, which was a very radical group that fomented bombings and so forth during that period. So even they today were controlled and funded by the Ford Foundation and other foundations like that. So these seemingly revolutionary groups sometimes have been funded and controlled by some of the big money. They're running this at us like a Gladio operation in today's world. Gladio was a system that was uncovered in Italy, but actually it goes back to the Left Behind, you know what I mean, operation that was put into place in the, not only the Eastern Bloc countries that were under Soviet rule, but the Western nations also developed their own, covert, black ops groups. And so the Gladio system, was uncovered in Milan, Italy, especially when there was a bombing of a train station there that killed quite a few. And then it came out publicly as to what was going on. And it's a secret, there's a Gassner, Professor Gassner out of Switzerland, written an excellent book on this subject called NATO's Secret Army. But you've got to pick that up and read that to understand this. But simply put, what we're seeing now, it looks like, is that the Gladio operations were underway post-World War II in Europe. And in the 50s and 60s into the 70s, and many of their operations that they did were bombings, and they blamed them on the Red Brigade in Italy, and they blamed them on Baader-Meinhof group in Germany. So they could easily foment some of these terrorist types of attacks and then blame those on some of the extremist groups within the country. And that's basically what they did. Now, what's happening here in America today is something that's similar. And so what's happening is that not only early in the 50s and 60s and 70s and so forth, the opposition, okay, to the Vietnam War brought a focus in, and that along with, you could say, permissivism as far as drugs went, especially drugs. You had the MK Ultra program that came in there in the 60s and 70s, and they actually started spreading LSD around. And so that undermined and transformed our country, along with the ideas about the Constitution coming in later on. And the main problem about the Constitution that I could perceive so far is that they begin to describe the Constitution as a living, breathing document. And if it is a living, breathing document, then by changing it, you can kill it. And that's basically what has been going on, is that if you say the Constitution is written and should be interpreted and strictly interpreted, that's one idea. The other idea is that it's a living, breathing document that changes. Changes what? No, the society changes. The document should not. The document, by not changing, protects our interests and our liberties and our rights. By giving in to the other proposition, argument, that it is a living, breathing document, then as a society become debased or less moralistic or whatever, then it's going to impose upon that document its own fallen views. And that's really what's been happening in today's world. That coupled with an inability to be responsible for your actions and excusing those actions and alluding those actions to some kind of an external, reason, is grown to immense proportions. It is one thing that I do not hear anymore. I'm sorry, it was my problem. I made a mistake. I do not hear that anymore. All I hear is, yeah, if they had done this, if they had done this, the government should have done this. No, that person over there didn't treat me right in this, and that's why I couldn't do this and that. It's all externalization of our problems. But that does away with seeking really the essence of our real problems and the struggle. Like Solzhenitsyn said, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it best. He said the battle line between good and evil run through the human heart. And that's what I have come to believe. And that's really what we're talking about here, is that we're talking about a system of rule, see, and ideas that have become less personally responsible and more able to be excused by all of these environmental influences I have no control over, right? Yeah, well, you have control over your own actions. But with that said, if you take, and I've written a short little synopsis, and in that synopsis, I think it best exemplifies this modern period and what has happened. And basically what has happened is that if you take, and I took just a young black boy growing up in a black ghetto in some inner city situation, and I use this as an example to place, this boy's, he's growing up and his involvement and his nurturing and his conditioning and programming and all that, to give the reader an idea of the what I call social dynamics of social synergy. And the idea of social synergy is that we have many influences that one or two influence that would say negative or dark influences may not result in a negative, dark manifestation or outcome. But if you have 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 11 very dark and negative influences, then the propensity for those to manifest and to eventually be realized in some dark, negative way is greatly increased. And that's what I see going on in today's world. If you have, say, this example of a young black boy growing up in a ghetto, let's just say he's a latchkey boy and his mom works. He brings home a little bit more than enough just to barely make it, their own food stamp, things like this. He grows up without any money in his pocket. He's discouraged. He's poor. he's downtrodden, he's depressed, he doesn't have what other boys have, and you know, that have more money. He goes to school, he's discriminated against maybe by other, you know, boys or whatever. He comes home, he joins a club or a boy steal a gang, he's indoctrinated by the gang, they lead him into crime, they lead him into drugs, and they lead him into alcoholism, and then he goes through a series of arrests as a juvenile. He's beginning to be institutionalized, not only because of alcohol, but the drugs and the gang. He comes in there, begins to hate the very leadership of the country that, you know, because they're discriminating against him. It makes him more susceptible to further gang influence and maybe cult influence. He might fall into some kind of a cult influence or so forth. He begins to eat food. He drinks water with fluoride in there, and that's bad for him. He eats the GMO foods. He's breathing more toxic air out here. There's chemicals everywhere in his society, at the school, cleaning materials, cleaning chemicals, this chemical. There's all kinds of chemicals in our food that we don't even know about anymore, whether it's organic or not. He goes to school. What's evolved in school is a social and moral relativist type of view, where do your own thing and anything goes, and permissivism. And the drugs are bad for you, but you feel good. There's peer pressure on the drug use side, and so forth. And this is sort of a social synergy insight into what the dynamics are. So he grows up to be a young man. He's maybe he's committed some minor crimes as a juvenile, and all of a sudden he'll go across the line. He gets involved in the legal system, begins to go on probation, often on probation, perhaps commits a major crime into the criminal system. They do a job on him in prison. He's perhaps raped or worse, still in prison and abused there. He comes out, maybe out of prison, as a very, very downtrodden, depressed individual, and then he'll fall maybe back into crime some more, and the criminal system is making a fortune by recycling these people into the system back and forth and so on. So anyway, I sort of use that as an example of the impending inputs and influences coming in, see, and then those influences together are taken collectively together are beginning to have an impact in destroying the country. And so if we pick up time-wise in here, you had the SDS that was a reaction, the Students for Democratic Society, to the Vietnam War. They did mobilize. They did infiltrate the SDS. The government did. They had FBI infiltrators and so forth. And then you had the Weathermen, which was an extreme group. They did bombings and so forth. They finally went after them. They did bombings, you know, and so forth. They finally put some of those people in prison, or finally excused them lately. Those people wind up supporting Obama in Chicago, some of those weathermen type people. And so we continue from the 70s and the 80s, 90s. We've got a cumulative effect of our school system, where the idea then is to be innovative to an extent where the children are not learning in school. Because they're depressed. They're one of the problems in our society now has been the broken home, see. So this one thing I did not make a point of was that this young black man that I was giving an example of earlier, a few minutes ago, came up in a broken home, see. So he had his mom there, was a good mom, and went out and earned a living as best she could, and didn't have that much money, but the dad wasn't there, see. So when the dad is not there, then the child just doesn't have that influence of a good father that we all need. And a father calls it like it is, and boy, you better obey him and not start doing some of these juvenile delinquency things that this example of this young boy that I just spoke about recently did. So there again, that young boy didn't have a dad, had a mom, pretty good mom probably, but then he was susceptible to gang interference, drugs, alcohol, GMO foods. I mean, all these things coming together then were very, very destructive. Later, you know, you say moving forward to say the 70s and 80s, then we went through the Vietnam era. Those people pretty well settled down, and then we get into an era of these new wars. Okay, and what happened beginning in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, we had a series of government actions, you say, or events that occurred. And one of the major milestones there was like the Waco, the attack on the Waco Branch Davidian, the burning down of the complex. Well, to go back and look at that, Bill and Hillary were right there. So they were responsible for that and the outcome of that. So we've got to look at that very, very carefully and with great concern. And then after... what happened after that was in 1994. That was April 19th, 1993. On April 19th, 1994, I was with a group of people in front of the Alamo, and it was the first militia muster in 88 years. And then what happened just a year later after that was the Oklahoma bombing and the Murrah building. What that did was undercut the militia movement instantly. And so... they tied that to militias in Michigan and so forth, and that way they could, in the public's mind, they could write off the militia movement, and that's what, you know, Clinton and all them did and Hillary did. So the militia movement was gone. Militia movement was a movement to try to help protect the rights and freedoms of American citizens, not to go out and just buy guns and go crazy. But the militia movement was moved against after the Oklahoma. Now, what's important about the Oklahoma thing is that Oklahoma City seemed to be a nexus for much of the activity, not only from the Murrah building bombing, but much of what went on after that seemed to have people coming in and out of the Oklahoma City area. If you're talking about the 1993 bombing of the World Trade building, there were individuals there coming through there before that, and then especially on the 2001 World Trade Center bombing, you had especially strong evidence that perhaps individuals that were in control of universities or so forth were consorting with other intelligence agencies in affecting those kinds of operations. Now, the most important thing that has occurred in this history, and this is just an overview real quick, so I'm just trying to give an idea of how we've been transformed here to the negative side, is that the 9/11 in 2001 was the most evil act ever perpetrated, you could say, against this country. Now, the debate continues on in my mind. It was totally an inside job. And then that was used as a means by which to foment an attack on Afghanistan and go after Osama bin Laden. And to create this war on the Islam, the war on the jihadists, see. But in doing that, then when we started the attacks and then the invasion into Iraq, thus the real jihadists, the real fervent, you could say, Islam jihadists begin to attack us. And so our initial 9/11, you know, event, and then our response to that and our attacks on their homeland, so to speak, created real terrorism. And thus that real terrorism then can be used as an example from then forward as this war on terrorism. And that's basically where we're at today. The 9/11 is used like a Pearl Harbor type of mechanism to take the American public, to put that forward. And what's important about the 9/11 event is that it hurt so many millions of people at a deep level, and it created a lot of intense hatred and resentment for these so-called terrorists out there that bombed our country, that bombed our buildings, say. But when you go back and look at it, and 911truth.org has 40 reasons to question the government explanation of 9/11. So I recommend you go to 911truth.org on the web, and there's and fish around in there and drill down in there, and you're going to find 40 reasons why to question the official explanation of 9/11. The premise all the time is that 9/11 was a legitimate attack on this country by foreign interests or foreign jihadists. If that is not the truth, and I do not believe that it's the truth, then everything since 9/11 has been a put-up job by the elitists to control us. And that's what I see going on right now, is that we're being screwed around all the time by this idea that that 9/11 was a legitimate attack by these foreign jihadists and terrorists. If that premise changes, then their power is taken away, and that's why they do everything they can in their power to continue the idea that the 9/11 was a legitimate attack on those buildings in New York City by these foreign terrorists. Without that being able to be substantiated and proven, and they never have proved it. Two planes crashing into those two buildings, the North and South Tower, could not have toppled those buildings. The key to seeing this is the building. Building 7 is what we're talking about. And when you look at that Building 7 and the way it came down and so forth, I mean, there were BBC reporters, like I said before, in the past, that were reporting that Building 7 came down. It was still there standing. So all of these people, these top elitists, are using 9/11, the mythology, the myth of 9/11, to perpetuate their dominance and the takedown of the whole country, this country, plus the world, Europe, and everything. So this is what's been going on, is that these people are using the 9/11 myth to control us and to use us and abuse us. Anyway, there was an important thing at the Bilderberg meeting that we went to in Copenhagen. But what occurred just days before that was something very, very interesting. And what that was that Christine Lagarde, who is the head of the International Monetary Fund, had attended a special meeting in England, okay? And the topic of the conversation, of all things, was inclusive capitalism, okay? And they're trying to describe this meeting as something that they've got to fix capitalism, is what they're saying. These are the very people that control International Monetary Fund and so forth and so on, and they're standing up at this inclusive conference. And not only Christine Lagarde was there, Mike Carney is the governor of the Bank of England. He's the chair of Financial Stability Board. He's right in the midst of reforming and restructuring this. Oh, we've got Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, founder of the Clinton Foundation, 42nd President of the United States. He carried out the Waco on us and presided over the Murrah Building and all that, these scandals, much less other ones. But at the top of the list was the Prince of Wales. So we've got people here, the wealthiest, richest people in the world. Lagarde, Christine Lagarde, who's managing director of the International Monetary Fund. We've got Mark Carney, governor of the Bank of England. Lionel Barber, the editor of the Financial Times, which is owned by the Rothschild interest, half-owned. Dominic Barton, global managing director of McKinsey & Company. Don't know much about him. Chan Yilong, chairman of the Sunshine Kaidi New Energy Group, okay, and then David Cott, chairman, chief executive, Honeywell, and so forth and so on. So they're going to be there, and at this inclusive capitalism initiative is what they're calling it. Who are we and what we believe? They're talking about what we believe in, you know. Well, if you get back to what they believe in, they don't say, okay, here's what they say that they believe in. Since the financial crisis of 2008, a significant debate has begun about how to improve capitalism so that it creates long-term value that sustains human endeavor without harming the stakeholders and a broad environmental critical to its success. Inclusive capitalism is a movement that seeks to respond to the serious dislocations caused by developments in the capitalism of the last 30 years. Worldwide increases in income inequality, large-scale corporate and financial scandals, and the fraying of public trust in business, historically high and persistent unemployment, and short-term approaches to managing and owning companies. At its core, inclusive capitalism is concerned with fixing the elevator of the economist Larry Kotz's famous analogy that portrays the American economy as an apartment block in which the penthouses have increased in size and the middle apartments are more and more squeezed. The basement is flooded, but what gets people down the most is that the elevator is broken. Well, what I have to add to this is that it's more than the elevator. We've got a privately owned Federal Reserve System, so we don't have control of our money creation system. Oh, that's one thing, a major thing right there. Another thing is that this analogy of the elevator is broken. I'd have to say that there's two elevators there. The people's elevator is broken. The elitist goes right to the top of the penthouses, bypasses the middle class apartments. And that's the way I see it basically. Is that nothing's broken. It's just that they're trying to patch it up and put a face on monopolistic crony capitalism that is getting now. People are rebelling, and the blowback now about what we call capitalism here in America or in the world is that we're up against crony monopolistic capitalism. The central banks of the world are privately owned. They all confluence into the Bank of International Settlements. And so as a result, the creation of credits worldwide, in the Western world at least, is monopolistic. And so as a result, we have these cronies that have taken over and managed the money system to benefit their own interest. So they have these little inclusive capitalism. They get up there and they talk about this, they talk about that. But, you know, what are we really talking about? We're not talking about meaningful change here. Then what's interesting is Lagarde and several of these people, they wind up, Lagarde for sure winds up over there in the Bilderberg meeting, okay? Copenhagen. Just days later, on the 29th, 30th or so, Christine Lagarde is there talking to people out on the terrace. There's photographs of her. And she's talking with some of the biggest people in the world out there on the patio about big issues here. So, just a couple of days earlier, she was at this inclusive capitalism conference, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden we find her out there in the Bilderberg a couple of days, two, 3 days later, talking to the movers and shakers of banks and big hedge funds and things like this. I mean, so what are we talking about here? We're talking about a world system of control through ideas. And that's basically what they have going, is that they teach us these things. They create something called, economics. And they try to put a good face on it. They create, out of Sweden, a Nobel Prize in economics, and they award this yearly to the great people that have pioneered in analyzing the velocity of money and the expansion of business in declining, deflationary times. I mean, you put the name on there that you want, but basically, it's just a bunch of BS. All they're doing is laying a bunch of BS on it. Well, we're Texans down here. We know not to step in a cow patio on a fresh one, especially. So we know BS when we see it, and the public at large is going through the same, experience out there. If they're beginning to see that this is not making sense anymore, And they know that these people own these great big, you know, interests, and they don't care a darn about them. And they're just going to continue on to feed us all of this this BS, you know what I mean? We're experiencing real difficulty now in ISIS, this jihadist group. Change the subject here. I'm going to finish up with the Iraq situation. And we've got, it's reported that there are 200 American contractors surrounded over there. And we've got, you know, real problems there on the ground and trying to, the problem with the contractors, and I of course don't have, you know, inside information, but there were U.S. personnel that left, okay? So immediately when they were getting ready to leave, they should have had a plane in there, and also those contractors should have gotten on vehicles if they had them on the base and drive out of there to Baghdad. Get out of there any way you could. Don't wait for some evacuation on a plane. You get in a car and you go south. This airfield, which was preparing for the shipment of F-16s into Baghdad, were on the ground, and these were technicians and American people getting those planes ready to go. Now they reported surrounded, okay, by jihadists, 200 approximately, and what the reports that I'm reading that are coming across the wire now is that the security and the Iraqi army, upon this announcement by the jihadists that if you don't leave now, we're going to come in and kill you, they threw down their arms, the security and the Iraqi army, and left, you know, from, you know, the site. So now we've got this, the 200 American contractors surrounded. We're going to have a hostage situation now. I mean, you know, when I first read that, you know, report, I knew, I had a bad feeling, just a gut feeling that this thing would go wrong. You know what I mean? Okay. And I just, you know, okay. Okay, they're saying now, the latest on this contractor thing, a U.S. contractor in Iraq told WorldNet Daily the Iraqi Air Force has begun evacuations from Balad Air Force Base, where 200 American contractors were trapped by the Al-Qaeda-inspired jihadists who have seized control of two cities and are now threatening Baghdad. Thank goodness. A contractor with Sallyport Global, who asked not to be named, told WorldNet Daily through a Skype instant message that he was transported from Balad to Baghdad and was communicating from a C-130 preparing to take off to Dubai. He said 300 in total have been evacuated from Balad, about 60 miles north of Baghdad, and another 100 are still awaiting airlift. He said the Iraqi Air Force is trying to evacuate everyone by midnight local time. And WorldNet Daily previously reported that private contractors who had recently returned to the U.S. said their former colleagues effectively had been abandoned by the U.S. military and were fighting for their lives against an army of jihadists, okay? Anyway, they were there. Thank goodness they're coming home. And there's still 100, though, that were supposed to be trying to get out of there and evacuate. But primarily we've got some, yeah. Anyway, that's really good news. Okay, we're reporting remote here outside this evening to conclude this broadcast, so there might be some motorcycle noise in the background there. We've got 40,000 motorcyclists in Austin, but we are doing a remote live from here tonight on this broadcast, so don't let that bother you. Oh, one thing also to think about is that David Rubenstein, okay, who's head of Carlyle Group, the Bush Investment Group, in 2002, he attended the World Economic Forum, which actually attracts most of the movers and shakers of the largest investment and also corporations in the world, investment, financial, and industrial corporations in the world. And I have a short clip here to play for you. But anyway, he said back then that on capitalism. We're back on this inclusive capitalism to tell you how they're trying to provide little rabbit trails for us. But this is really insightful, more than a rabbit trail, that David Rubenstein said, because it really reveals their thinking. Their thinking is to focus in on the Chinese model and to give us that Chinese model, it seems like to me. And this is what he said here, and I'll play this. It's 47, 48 seconds, and then we'll come back and finish with comments on it.
David, did you want to cap things off? Then we are going to move to the floor.
My main point is, well, first, if the minimum wage were increasing, I'd say that'd be fine with me. I just don't think it'll solve all our economic problems. Our economic problems are very deep because of the debt and the deficit and other things. I think we've got about 3 to 4 years in the West to improve the economic model we have. And if we don't do that soon, I think that we've lost the game in competing against emerging market capitalism or state capitalism, because I think they just have a more efficient model right now, which is going to take a lot of jobs away from the West. So I think we've got to work through these problems. If we don't do it in 3 or 4 years, when we have this kind of session 3 or 4 years from now, the game will be over for the type of capitalism that many of us have lived through and thought was the best type of capitalism.
Okay, did you get that? Yeah. What he basically said is that there's problems with capitalism, and that we've got to come up within the next 2 or 3 years or so with a better capitalism. He said maybe, just maybe, that Chinese model of state capitalism, you know, is the model. Well, the state capitalism reminds me of the Soviet Union and those real statist type of organizations. But one thing that you could be very revealing about what David Rubenstein said is that you see a rise from this elitist group, whether the ones attending World Economic Forum or you see the Bilderberg group, but they're all into public-private partnerships, and they make a big point of pushing that. They have a younger group now of under 30, and they make an emphasis at their meetings and their conferences and symposiums that, boy, that's the way to get things financed and get things done. I will agree that private enterprise does have a lot more get up and go than governments. And whenever you have governments, you have exactly what we had, say, with the VA system here, where you had everyone that had jobs, but very few of those people evidently were working. They were, you know, not scheduling properly. They were hiding, and the time that it took to falsify records and everything else could have been taking care of some of the vets. So in a socialist communist system, you have everyone that has a job, but the productivity is not very good. And that's actually what's happening in Europe today, as Europe has gotten Western Europe and Great Britain and so forth, as they move towards much more of a socialist model where they're working and heavily taxed, and Denmark they're taxed up to about 55% of their income, then you have an inefficiency that occurs in the economy, and they're just not able to compete on an international scale like real free market capitalism. Now, when you're talking about free market capitalism, you're talking about things that have been taken especially offshore from America, and much of our, because of the cheap wages in the Pacific Basin area and the island countries, Indonesia and Thailand and so forth, and China especially. They're very, very cheap labor. So these corporations took much of our manufacturing offshore, and thus to attain a greater competitive price-wise. Then you have that confluencing back to us through the Walmarts, made in China products. So if we continue to buy those things, and I must say I'm guilty myself, you know, the price is hard to resist. When you can pay $20 for something instead of $40, there's great, you know what I mean, movement there to pay the lesser amount. So I'm guilty of that also. But we've got to be more careful in our spending and try to, you know, buy more products made in this country. The Iraq, getting back to that and making some concluding remarks there, is that Iran is coming in now. We've had people that are trying to comment, okay, on the Iraq situation. But the problem with the Iraq, situation is that we have, okay, a mixed bag there, you could say. The ISIS has reared its ugly head just especially just recently, okay, in this Iraq situation. Previously, they were going in and were one of the most ruthless jihadist organizations in the Syria area. And evidently, they pulled back to the northeast part of Syria. They're adjacent to Iraq, and then they're extending some of their power and influence and war making into northern Iraq. I put forward an idea years ago when this thing first blew up in Iraq, and it was the idea that was this, and probably it should have been at least trying to be initiated, but with these jihadist groups probably wouldn't have made it either. But what I had proposed back then was to create three states in Iraq. The southern state would have been more Shiite, the middle state more Sunni, and the northern state would have been, Kurdish, okay? And something like that might have worked. And then you could also make you could make like a District of Columbia, but it would be a District of Baghdad, at the capital there. And so you would have a parliament, a national parliament there. You would have state parliaments in the respective three states that were created. But one important solution to keeping it unified as a country, as a whole, would be to take the oil revenues and divide those on a proportionate basis by per person, by population in those three states. And then so the government would take in the oil revenues and redistribute those back to the state organizations, retaining enough to cover some of the overheads of the national government. Something like that might have worked. But what you're looking at in countries like Iraq and Libya and so forth is that usually it takes a strong man to control those countries. And so as far as this experiment in democracy or in republicanism or whatever you want to call it, you know, democratic voting and all that, it hasn't worked out too well in these previous very strong man types of economies or political country in these countries that previously had strong men that ruled. And so what I see happening is that it's going to be very, very difficult to teach them what was over 200 years of conducting and managing ourselves in this country, even though the corruption is grinding us into the ground now in this country. But at least we still can vote. We still can change out some politicians. Yes, there is corruption at the poll, at the election place, but we still have a say in more ways than most countries in the world. And we've got to try to rebuild and reform this country. This recent victory, you know, by an upset, you know what I mean, U.S. House by this Tea Party exemplifies that, yes, your vote does count, and it can make a difference, and you can exert some influence through that voting. Anyway, we want to thank each and every one of you out there that listens, and we want to thank all those people that helped us get to Copenhagen. If you go into thesecrettruth.com to our previous program last week, you'll see click-offs. If you go into our program tonight, we have click-offs in there to give you additional information on inclusive capitalism and such. We hope that we better inform our listening audience. We don't have all the answers, but we try to point people in the right direction or to the people that can truly secure those right answers for you. So give us an email. Our emails are up on the site. And contact us anytime that is convenient with you. But anyway, thank you for listening tonight. We'll be signing off, and we'll be back next week the same time, 7 to 9, Saturday night from Austin Live from Austin, Texas. Thank you for or being with us, and we certainly thank you for all the support. And we'll be out in that secret space program end of the